is Wednesday, February 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Ousted Myanmar leader Aung San Suu Kyi faces new charges.
The general said that there has been irregularity.
Plus, former U.S. President Donald Trump faces a new legal challenge over the January 6th riot at the Capitol.
House Homeland Security Committee Chair Benny Thompson's suit accuses Trump of inciting the insurrection.
We'll have these stories and more next. Authorities in Myanmar have filed a new charge against ousted leader Aung San Suu Kyi that may allow her to be held indefinitely without trial. The United Nations is calling for the additional charge to be dropped and for Suu Kyi to be released.
I think the adding of a new charge, just our reaction is to continue, I think, in our firm denunciation of everything that has happened in Myanmar, the overturning of the will, democratic will of the people, and we need to see, and the ongoing arrest and detention of political leaders, of activists, and the inability of people to protest peacefully.
To better understand the developing situation in Myanmar, I spoke earlier with Tan Luen Tun, the VOA Burmese service chief.
They call it environmental restriction violation because it is mainly about that restrict people movement to go outside and preventing people go without masks and a rally and participating in a rally. I don't know the exact date of the charge, which in that sense, Aung San Suu Kyi went out to participate in a rally or something like that. But it is a kind of a similar charge as they put it on the President Nguyen Nhiem. So this is a kind of an addition of the new charges. But the press conference by the military actually is hinting that there might be a more possible heavier charges in pipeline.
You mentioned that the military signaled that there could be additional heavier charges. Did they give any inkling as to what they could be?
Because they mentioned that there's a kind of ongoing investigations about possible corruption. And then they particularly mentioned about Dokinji Foundation. Dokinji Foundation is with the name Aung San Suu Kyi's mother. And she, with her name, there was a kind of a charity foundation, which was actually presided by the Aung San Suu Kyi herself before she took over. She took the official position. So there's a lot of fundraising for that particular foundation. And this military press conference, the general said that there has been, they found a kind of irregularity, such as a kind of foreign currency or foreign donation coming into Dokinji Foundation. It is kind of regarded firmly as a kind of another possible charge against her.
Over the past few days, the internet has been shut down again in Myanmar. What do we know about the status of that particular service, as well as other communication services going into and coming out of the country?
Internet was shut down completely in the day when they staged the military takeover. And then there was a lot of disruption anyway, especially to the banking sector. So I, as far as I know, according to that, a few insiders in Burma, military government is now trying to avoid that kind of generalized disruption on the internet. So they try to put it some sort of control over certain part of the activity, such as Facebook or certain IP address or certain URL. So they, as far as I know, which is confirmed by military required all those telecom companies and internet service provider to install the kind of firewall device, which they would control the kind of internet traffic and other activities. So that's why in a period 2 or 3 days, and we see every night from 1 a.m. to 9 a.m. in Burma local time, complete shutdown of internet. So people inside Burma believe that it is a kind of a testing period or just doing that kind of a switch over to the internet, kind of a new server and a new firewall control.
VOA Burmese Service Chief Tan Luen Tun. Tom Andrews, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in Myanmar, says that he is terrified over the planned mass protests on Wednesday and the possibility of troops converging on them. He adds that the military is on the precipice of committing even greater crimes against the people of Myanmar and is calling for the planned rallies to be allowed to proceed without detentions or violence. The Taliban is urging the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden to stick to a 2020 troop withdrawal peace agreement, describing it as the most effective way of ending the war in Afghanistan. The Biden administration is in the process of reviewing whether the Taliban is living up to its commitments under the deal, this before deciding to withdraw the remaining 2,500 U.S. troops from Afghanistan and an end to what has been the longest war in U.S. history. A rocket attack at a U.S.-led military base in Kurdish northern Iraq on Monday killed a civilian contractor and wounded five other people, including a U.S. service member. Reuters' Brian Wood takes it from here.
A Shia militia group with alleged ties to Iran has claimed responsibility for the bombing without providing evidence, saying it targeted American occupation in Iraq. It was the deadliest attack on U.S.-led forces there in almost a year, where tensions have escalated between U.S.-aligned Iraqi and Kurdish forces and Iran-aligned militias. Erbil is the regional capital in Iraq's northern Kurdish area. Kurdish security forces said at least three rockets hit near the international airport there. Adjacent to the airport is a U.S.-occupied military base, where Reuters reporters heard loud explosions and saw a fire erupt. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said on Monday the United States was outraged by the attack. In a statement, he said he had reached out to Kurdistan's leadership to, quote, discuss the incident and to pledge our support for all efforts to investigate and hold accountable those responsible. The last deadly attack to target the coalition killed one British and two American personnel in March last year.
Brian Wood reports for Reuters News. Speaking to reporters at the White House on Tuesday, Press Secretary Jen Psaki said it was a priority for the administration to determine who was responsible for the attack.
I will convey that we are outraged by last night's rocket attack in the Iraqi Kurdistan region. Secretary Blinken has reached out to the Kurdistan Regional Government Prime Minister Barzani, and Secretary Austin is speaking with his counterpart to offer assistance with the investigation and to help hold accountable those responsible for this attack. But we have not determined attribution at this point.
She added that the administration reserves the right to respond in the time and in the manner of its choosing. A Democratic congressman is suing former President Donald Trump over the U.S. Capitol riot. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani has the details.
Trump's Senate impeachment acquittal is expected to lead to a wave of litigation over the insurrection now that he's lost some legal protections as an ex-president. House Homeland Security Committee Chair Benny Thompson's suit accuses Trump of inciting the insurrection and conspiring with his lawyer and extremist groups to keep Congress from certifying the presidential election results. Several other lawmakers are expected to join the suit, which was brought under a law known as the Ku Klux Klan Act. It bans violence or intimidation meant to keep members of Congress or other federal officials from carrying out constitutional duties. Sagar Magani, Washington.
The World Health Organization and other aid agencies are moving quickly to try to gain control over a new outbreak of the deadly Ebola virus in Guinea. Guinea is one of three countries that was affected by the 2014 West African outbreak, the largest in history. Lisa Schlein has more.
The outbreak in Guinea was detected February 14th, just 1 week after a new outbreak of Ebola was identified in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. The two outbreaks are unrelated, but the World Health Organization says both face similar challenges and both can benefit from new treatments and recent experiences. The WHO reports seven family members who attended a burial ceremony in the town of Gweke, Guinea, were infected with the virus, and three have since died. WHO spokeswoman Margaret Harris says 115 contacts have been identified, and the majority have been traced.
Confidence with the experience and expertise built during the previous outbreaks that the health teams in Guinea are on the move to quickly trace the path of the virus and curb further infections, but it certainly will be a big job. And WHO is supporting the Guinean authorities to set up testing, contact tracing, treatment structures, and to bring the overall response to full speed.
Harris says WHO offices in surrounding countries have been contacted and preparedness plans are being put in place. The 2014 West African Ebola outbreak began in Guinea and quickly spread to neighboring Sierra Leone and Liberia. By the time the epidemic ended in 2016, 28,000 people had been infected with the disease and more than 11,000 had died. Harris says many lessons have been learned from previous outbreaks to keep the virus from spreading. She says it is important to have a strategic response plan, get it into action early, and to coordinate all aspects of the operation.
What is critical is decentralizing the operations to the lowest level, making sure your operations are where the community are, and that the community owns the operations, that your work is community-centered, and that you work with the community. A one-size-fits-all approach to community engagement isn't effective.
Turning to the other Ebola outbreak, the World Health Organization has confirmed four cases, including two deaths in the city of Butembo in DRC's North Kivu province. The WHO reports nearly 300 contacts have been identified and tracing is underway. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A former soccer federation chief and a member of parliament pleaded not guilty Tuesday to crimes against humanity charges stemming from the Central African Republic Civil War, which erupted almost a decade ago. Taking place at the International Criminal Court in the Netherlands, the first global trial on these events comes as fresh violence tears through the CAR. Lisa Bryant reports.
Ngaisona is also criminally responsible for the crimes against humanity of 1. Murder.
The charges facing Central Africans Patrice Edouard Ngaisona and Alfred Yekatom include murder, torture, mutilation, rape, and the use of child soldiers. Both are accused of being key members of the country's mostly Christian anti-Balaka militias, which revolted against Muslim Seleka rebels who seized power in 2013.
Mr. Ngaisona, I ask you the same question. I trust that you understand the nature of the charges brought against you. Is this correct?
Wearing dark suits and mandatory coronavirus face masks during their first day of trial at the ICC, both men pleaded not guilty. But prosecution lawyer Kweku Vanderpooy offered a different take.
The victims of the Central African Republic conflict deserve to be seen, they deserve to be heard, and they deserve their day in court. Justice must prevail. And the evidence in this case will establish the individual criminal responsibility of Patrice Edouard Ngaisona and Alfred Yekatom for crimes against humanity and war crimes in violation of Articles 7 and 8 of the Rome Statute.
Ngaisona was the country's one-time sports minister and later headed its soccer association. His other alleged job as a leader of the anti-Balaka movement. He was arrested in France in 2018. Yekatom, a member of parliament, is accused of commanding the militias on the ground. He also was arrested the same year. Human Rights Watch's Associate International Justice Director Elise Kepler calls this trial a milestone and says more must take place targeting all sides of the conflict.
We're in a situation right now where impunity has been a constant challenge for the Central African Republic. Almost no perpetrators have ever been held to account for crimes, cycles of grave crimes committed in the country. And we see the effects of that in fueling further violence.
The trial comes as the CAR faces an upsurge in fighting involving some of the same actors as a decade ago. That starts with former President François Bozizé, whom the anti-Balakas supported and whom the Seleka rebels ousted from power in 2013. The current fighting erupted after Bozizé was barred from running in December's presidential election. The CAR's protracted violence has uprooted hundreds of thousands of people, with many seeking refuge in neighboring countries. Even as he built his case against the two defendants, lawyer Vanderpoy said the trial was not an indictment of one or the other side of the conflict. There was enough tragedy, he said, for both to bear blame. Last month, the first Seleka rebel arrested also was handed to the ICC. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
This is Science in a Minute.
As the new Biden administration took office, some expressed concern that the Trump administration's supported goal of returning humans to the moon by 2024 might be in jeopardy. President Biden's press secretary, Jen Psaki, spoke of NASA's Artemis moon missions in a recent briefing.
Through the Artemis program, the United States government will work with industry and international partners to send astronauts to the surface of the moon, another man and a woman to the moon, which is very exciting, conduct new and exciting science, prepare for future missions to Mars, and demonstrate America's values. To date, only 12 humans have walked on the moon. That was half a century ago. The Artemis program, a waypoint to Mars, provides exactly, you know, the opportunity to add numbers to that, of course. Lunar exploration has broad and bicameral support in Congress, most recently detailed in the FY 2021 omnibus spending bill, and certainly we support this effort and endeavor.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. France and the leaders of Africa's Sahel region have agreed to step up efforts to fight insurgents in the region. International Edition's Chinedu Ofor spoke with reporter Katerina Howe in Bamako, Mali, to get the details.
The expected troop withdrawal from France isn't happening. Instead, President Emmanuel Macron announced renewed or continued commitment with French troops with the Sahelian countries. What France is looking to do is to focus more on the fight against terrorism and also allowing for the Sahelian countries to move in to rebuild the government presence, move in with economic development where France has pushed back the militants.
Do you think the meeting could have achieved more? Was there a sense of disappointment?
I believe the fact that there's not a scale back of the French presence in the Sahel is probably what the West African leaders were looking for. I mean, we know it's a difficult area to be operating in. We're also going to see the addition of 1,200 Chadian troops. What we are waiting for is the European joint force known as Takuba, who is supposed to give support to the French troop and also conduct more operations in the regions as the French are focusing more on the fight against terrorists.
Aside from the military commitments, any economic commitment for France?
No new economic commitments at this point. Most of the commitments were made last year. Some of the funds have been made available to the West African countries, the Sahelian states, but we're still awaiting a large portion of the funds that still have not reached the countries. And obviously, without the funds, issues such as economic development and humanitarian aid won't be available until those funds are also made available.
Katerina Howe reports from Bamako, and she was speaking to International Edition's Chinedu Ofor. The information technology giant Google has agreed to pay an Australian media company to host news material ahead of a planned mandatory bargaining code. Phil Mercer has that story.
Google's deal with Seven West Media, which publishes the Perth-based West Australian newspaper and other titles, is the first of seven such arrangements the tech giant is expected to make in Australia. A law being introduced this week in federal parliament in Canberra would require large technology companies to pay to use Australian news stories. The legislation would make Australia the first country to force big tech firms to pay for news content. Google, which had called the law unworkable, and Facebook have threatened to downgrade their services to Australians or even walk away. They've argued that by using stories from other publishers, they generate more internet traffic for the websites run by traditional media outlets. But in an apparent softening of that stance, Google has reached an agreement with Seven West Media, reportedly worth $23 million a year. Belinda Barnett is a lecturer in media at Swinburne University of Technology, a public research university based in Melbourne. She believes it's a good result for the Australian company.
It does sound like they've come up with a fairly lucrative deal for them, around 30 million Australian, but that figure hasn't been confirmed yet. Seven West owns quite a lot of regional outlets as well, so it has the potential to benefit the regional news outlets that it owns and the journalists employed by them.
The Australian government said a deal with Facebook was very close. As their advertising revenues collapsed, traditional broadcasting and publishing companies have for years complained that social media platforms have benefited from their quality reporting without paying for it. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Two Hong Kong democracy activists have pleaded guilty to organizing or participating in an illegal assembly during massive anti-government protests during 2019. The two were among nine prominent activists whose trial began on Tuesday. The others include Martin Lee, an 82-year-old veteran of Hong Kong's democracy movement, and Jimmy Lai, a newspaper publisher who is being held without bail on other charges related to his pro-democracy activities. The two who pleaded guilty were An Nok Hin and Leung Yu Chung, both former members of the Hong Kong legislature. The charges are widely seen as a move by China to crack down on dissent in the semi-autonomous territory. And finally, the price for a single Bitcoin briefly crossed the $50,000 threshold Tuesday before closing above $48,700. To learn more about what's behind the cryptocurrency's recent gains, I spoke with William Luther, assistant professor of economics at Florida Atlantic University and director of the Sound Money Project at the American Institute for Economic Research.
Well, it's important to recognize that Bitcoin is first and foremost a medium of exchange. It has the potential to be a money. And so all the speculation surrounding Bitcoin concerns the extent to which it's actually going to do that. So the demand for Bitcoin is primarily driven by people's usefulness of Bitcoin as a medium of exchange, or their expectation that it will be a useful medium of exchange in the future. And so broad brushstroke, people are expecting that Bitcoin is more likely to be a useful medium of exchange in the future. That's why the price is being driven up today. Now, with respect to this recent surge, so if we go back to early December, Bitcoin's price, a little less than $20,000 today, close to $50,000, as you mentioned. What has happened in this time period that's caused Bitcoin's usefulness as a medium of exchange to shoot up?
Well, there are two things that come to mind. First is an investigative report on an adult website that then forced that site to lose credit card processing from a number of vendors, and they started using Bitcoin as a way to earn money. And the second really has been Elon Musk and Tesla investing a lot of money into Bitcoin.
So here you have what at least one source ranks as the 10th most visited website in the world, and it's completely cut off from traditional payment processors. But it's not cut off from all payment processors because it's still accepting payments in Bitcoin and a few other cryptocurrencies. I think a lot of people, when they saw this, they didn't realize that before that traditional payment processors could just cut off a merchant like this. And so whether they're customers or not, they look to the future and they think, well, if they can cut off this business, then they might cut off other businesses in the future. And so in the future, people might want access to a payment mechanism that can't just cut off merchants so easily.
Now, you mentioned medium of exchange. Unlike the dollar, the euro, other currencies around the world, Bitcoin isn't pegged to a particular economy. There's no intrinsic value to a Bitcoin other than the value that other people place on it. So what does that do in terms of kind of regulating the value of such, because it's not pegged to something that many people see in a physical world?
So most monies that we use today are not backed by anything. They're intrinsically worthless. That is, they're either useful as a money, as a medium of exchange, or they're not useful at all. A dollar is not backed by anything. A dollar is only worth what other people are willing to hand over in exchange for those dollars. But where the dollar and the euro and the renminbi differ from Bitcoin is that those government-issued currencies, they have some demand support from their government. If you're in the U.S. and you're using dollars, you don't have to worry that the government is going to suddenly stop using dollars. And the government is a big player in the U.S. economy. And so the value of the dollar has a sort of lower bound, right? Because you can always hand over these notes to the government and get some base level value there. With Bitcoin, there is no government standing at the ready to accept these, say, in the payment of taxes or in the payment of fees. And so the value can fluctuate quite a bit. There's no base level of value there because there's no inherent demand support from a big institution like a government. And so that does create scope for much bigger swings in the purchasing power of Bitcoin relative to, say, the dollar or the euro.
That was the director of the Sound Money Project at the American Institute for Economic Research and Florida Atlantic University Assistant Professor William Luther. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by visiting voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well and be safe.
Editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has suspended and initiated the process to terminate the asylum cooperative agreements with the governments of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras as the first steps on the path to greater partnership and collaboration in the region laid out by President Joe Biden. The agreement signed with Guatemala in 2019 allowed the U.S. to send asylum seekers from El Salvador and Honduras who crossed the U.S. southern border to first seek refuge in Guatemala. Similar agreements were signed with El Salvador and Honduras, but never implemented. The February 2nd executive order is aimed at creating a comprehensive regional framework to address the causes of migration, manage migration throughout North and Central America, and provide safe and orderly processing of asylum seekers at the U.S. border. To be clear, said Secretary of State Antony Blinken in a statement, these actions do not mean that the U.S. border is open. While we are committed to expanding legal pathways for protection and opportunity here and in the region, the United States is a country with borders and laws that must be enforced. He added, we are also committed to providing safe and orderly processing for all who arrive at our border. But those who attempt to migrate irregularly are putting themselves and their families at risk on what can be a very dangerous journey. The Biden administration believes there are more suitable ways to work with its partner governments to manage migration across the region. The United States will build on its strong relationships and support these governments' efforts to address forced displacement without placing undue burden on them, especially as they seek to recover from the COVID-19 pandemic. Our approach, said Secretary Blinken, will continue to provide support for their national action plans under the Comprehensive Regional Protection and Solutions Framework through international humanitarian partners. The U.S. is committed to addressing the root causes of forced displacement and irregular migration, including by combating corruption and impunity, upholding its obligations to protect refugees, and working with partners to promote opportunity and prosperity for people and communities across the region.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.